Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly. Toward his weekly meeting with the...
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. Tonight's guest is Jeremy Braddock. He teaches literature, media, and sound studies at Cornell University. And we're talking about his book, Fire Sign, The Electromagnetic History of Everything, as told on 9 comedy albums. Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, I know for a fact, and you write about it in your book, you're not of the generation that would have been most in tune and affected by Fire Sign Theater. How did you get interested in them?
Well, my mother's youngest brother or younger brother was born, I think, in 1945, 1946. So he was completely of the Fire Sign generation. And he started giving me and my brother Fire Sign records when we were, or when I was 12 or 13. So we kind of sampled them tentatively and but listened to them over time. So in a sense, I really did grow up with them.
It's so interesting because I was a child of the 50s, so I was at the perfect age for when they came out. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things that you bring up in this book, and you make it very clear to people. This is definitely a book about Fire Sign Theater, but it's not just going to be a fan book. You're doing a lot more things with the history of the Fire Sign Theater of the book. Could you just talk about a few of them? This is a media, I guess I want to, that's sort of unfair. That was too open-ended a question. This is really a media studies history of how the Fire Sign Theater, first of all, produced their work, how the work was listened to, and its an impact on other media.
Yeah. Yes. Thanks. That is what I'm trying to do. So I for a long time I have this sense that that Fire Sign Theater really deserved a book, and I wanted to be the person to write it. And my training in college and in graduate school was in was in English and American literature, and so you know they're, as I'm sure you know, they are super literary. They really, really think hard about language. But I also knew that to write a sort of conventionally literary study of Fire Sign Theater would be leaving a lot of things out. So it seemed to me that, you know, that I could pay attention to their uses of language and also kind of in telling the history of the group, say where that attention came from, but also to focus on what their major records on Columbia Records seemed to be about, and that had to do with media technology. So things were changing a lot, like both in the recording studio, but also in culture over the period of their Columbia contract, which was 1967 to 1975. So they do 9 albums over those years. But they're also so they're thinking a lot in a way that other people who are attentive to media technologies at the time are not necessarily so much. They're thinking about the history as well as the prospective futures of these media. So one of the ways in which I structure the book is, on the one hand, it's quite chronological. So, you know, I begin with their prehistory and talk about their first album in the first chapter and stuff like that. But each of the 5 chapters is also devoted to a particular medium. So the first chapter is about the LP album. And then I have chapters about cinema and artificial intelligence and television and radio.
It's really fascinating when you talked about the influences of in the introduction. Or the preface, excuse me, the various influences are amazing. And at the end, there's a whole multi-page list of rap albums that have sampled Fire Sign Theater at the end of the book. That stuff I didn't know at all. And it's really shocking to read that list.
It's amazing. I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because that's one of the things that folks haven't picked up on as much. And I should say that I'm drafting a sort of something I'm going to post on Substack, because I discovered 4 or 5 more samples. And I think the first sample is DJ Mark the 45 King in 1989.
Yeah.
And the most recent one is, you know, certainly within the last couple of years. And so it's fascinating, you know, looking at the list of samples, because on the one hand, you can see how sampling techniques change over time, because, you know, you're looking at the sort of 30-year history of the way in which samples are used in hip hop. But on the other hand, or at the same time, you can also see that, you know, the ways in which the DJs are really listening to each other, because almost nothing is sampled twice.
Wow.
So you can tell that they're like, yeah, if they know that, you know, Mark the 45 King, you know, sampled something from I think we're all in Bozos on this bus, that's off limits now. So something else has to be sampled. And in some cases, you can see them sort of speaking to each other through their samples.
What was amazing is at the time that Fireside Theater was putting out these records, as you write about in your book, it was the rock critics who seemed to be on top of what they were doing. There's a great, a good example is Grail Marcus's Lipstick Traces, the book that was about the alternative music at that time. His book described Fireside Theater as having the secret history of the 20th century. And it's amazing. It really was the rock critics who were on top of what they were really doing.
I think that's really true. I mean, there's other people. I mean, there are a couple academic studies from pretty early on, but I think that the rock critics, I mean, on the one hand, a lot of them are English majors, you know, like Grail Marcus.
Right, right.
Actually did some PhD work at Berkeley, and Robert Christgau famously, you know, pronounces himself as a Dartmouth English major. And even people like Lester Bangs, who also wrote really insightful things about Firesign, you know, I'm not even sure if he went to college or not, but was incredibly well-read and was always talking about literature in his writing. So I think that, you know, that sort of heroic moment of music criticism, I'd also include, like, you know, Ellen Willis and Nelson George and Greg Tate, that they are people who have, you know, academic backgrounds in literature and culture, but also I think by virtue of the fact that they're music critics, they know how to listen carefully as well, and they're attuned to what's happening both in cultures of sound, but also in cultures of technology.
Let's talk about the members, the core members first. David Ausman, sure. Phil Austin, Peter Bergman, and Phil Proctor. You have sort of mini biographies of all four of them in the beginning. What was amazing to me, when we can't go over them because it would be taking years, they had really varied experiences in different art forms. And they all end up meeting, like, in radio.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So they're all college boys, and
yeah, but they're not like they're not like typical college boys, because they've all had some really unusual, in-depth intellectual experiences.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Although, isn't that what we hope that college people will have?
Yeah, that's what we hope for, but that's not what happened.
So Bergman and Proctor meet at Yale, and they meet, Yale had and still has a famous drama program. And Proctor was training specifically to be an actor, and in fact, you know, immediately went to New York and was performing in New York after he graduated. And Bergman was a director and a screenwriter, and he got a fellowship to go to the Literarisches Colloquium in Berlin in the early 60s, where he's working, among other things, alongside Tom Stoppard, who is then drafting what would become Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Oh, my God.
And Bergman has by far the most interesting sort of, itinerary, and, yeah. and I won't go down that rabbit hole unless you want to.
No, no, no. That would take a whole show.
So they both have backgrounds in theater. Phil Austin grows up in Fresno, and he goes to Bowdoin for a little while and drops out and goes to San Francisco, where he works briefly with the Actors Workshop, which was a really important theater group that was one of the first companies to commit to like the European avant-garde and theater of the absurd in particular. So they are also, if you've heard of the famous production of Waiting for Godot at San Quentin Prison, that's the Actors Workshop. And I think that Austin comes to San Francisco shortly after that. So I think that's where he learns about Ionesco and Beckett and you know a number of playwrights who sorry about the chime who become influential at Firesign later, and then David Osman went to Columbia, and then he went to radio first in a way. So he was working at the Pacific at WBAI in New York, and had a poetry program where he interviewed a lot of the sort of downtown poets who would later come together on the St. Mark's Poetry Project. So that's their background, and for various reasons they end up in LA in the mid to late 60s. And both Austin and Osman are working at the Pacifica station there, KPFK, which at the time does not have an overnight radio program. And Bergman sort of wheedles his way into the overnight program, and they all begin improvising on that. So that's a longer answer than you needed, but it is definitely an interesting backstory.
So how and why does Columbia Records decide to put out their first record, Waiting for the Electrician? And that sort of seems like totally a wild gamble.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right, and I think that it took a while for them to be convinced that it had been a good idea, because oftentimes album sales sort of prove themselves over time, and that was especially true for Firesign's first album. But Columbia was, I think, the largest record company in the world, but they had also committed to rock music relatively late. And so they had only one sort of staff producer, which at the time was an important designation, only one staff producer in L.A., who was a guy named Gary Usher, who... it's interesting for a number of reasons, but produced some important records by the Byrds and so on. And so to hear Usher tell the story, he was given more or less carte blanche to start signing people in L.A. And, you know, this is also the time that that the LP as a form is really taking off. So, you know, prior to about 66, it's really about 45. So in any case, Usher becomes aware that there's this popular radio program on KPFK, and he approaches Bergman about the idea of what I think, and you get different versions of the story, but it sounds like he's thinking there'll be just like a one-off novelty record about the radio show, which is called Radio Free Oz. But Bergman and Phil Austin, who had worked with Gary Usher in another capacity, said, actually, we have this thing called Firesign Theater. This is the album we want to do. And so so they persuaded him to allow him to do the album. So it is astonishing that they had as much freedom as they did. And another marker of the freedom that they had was that when they signed that deal with Columbia, they exchanged the mechanical royalty payments, which would be the each time your song would be played on the radio, you'd get a certain amount of money, which is how a lot of pop musicians made money. So they exchanged that for unlimited time in the studio. And that really allowed them to, to work iteratively and really craft both the writing and the sound of the record.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jeremy Braddock. He teaches literature, media, and sound studies at Cornell University, and we're talking about his book, Fire Sign, The Electromagnetic History of Everything, as told on 9 comedy albums. As you write in the book, not so much in the first album, I think they really found themselves on the second album, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once, when you're not anywhere at all. But as you write in the book, they use the long playing record as a medium for representing and evaluating all other media. And that's exactly what happens. Once I read that sentence in this book, it really made sense in listening to what they're trying to do. They're really critiquing all other media using the long playing record.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, they are. So it's, let's see, for example, one of the things that that maybe helps to understand how they get the idea for their just sort of orientation to their work is that the studio that they were recording in LA was called Columbia Square. The building is still there on Sunset and Gower, I believe. And it was built in 1938 as sort of like the state of the art Art Deco building for radio broadcasting. So and had been converted by Columbia Records. So it was the CBS radio building. It's the same CBS is the same company that owned Columbia Records, and it was converted for recording in the early 60s. But there had been no sort of substantial remodeling. So the musicians were all recording on the sound stages that were used for radio, and a lot of the old gear for radio was still around.
They loved that. Yeah. They were in their element.
They did. Yeah, absolutely, because they had grown up with radio, and you know, you could still hear old radio, you know, on the radio, like especially on radio stations like KPFK. So one thing that they did was to try to figure out the old techniques for how, you know, why those radio programs sounded the way they did. And that had to do with both performance and also the equipment, most of which was still around. But another thing that they thought of, that they knew, was that the Columbia Square Studios was the place where a lot of propaganda or morale broadcasts from, you know, we could say anti-fascist radio broadcasts from the 40s had originated, specifically by this playwright named Norman Corwin, who often later worked with. And so I think they were thinking a lot about what it meant to be, you know, inheriting this studio at the time, you know, at the high watermark of Vietnam, and what it would mean to be, engaging contemporary politics and culture with that background.
As you write elsewhere in the book, they thought about media both speculatively, and the example you give is, what if road signs could talk? Antelope Highway.
Yeah, they can now.
And historically. So both speculatively and historically. And that's the weird feel for their records, because there's this thing where there's a lot of old sounding bits that sound like from old radio, but it's also really gets real strange stuff about the future. It's very odd. Let's talk about how people listen to the record, and I can attest that you writing about it is correct.
These were
records that were meant to be listened to closely many times.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I mean, one of the things they realized right away was that, I guess let's put it this way, there had been a pretty big boom in comedy albums in the early 60s. So things like Bob Newhart and Bill Cosby, Stan Freberg, Moms Mabley, Dick Gregory, these were records that were very high selling records. But it was, you know, one thing that you'll see actually a lot, especially with the rock critics who you mentioned, is that the problem with a lot of these albums is that, as Chris Gow says, you listen to it once and laugh, but then do you really play it a second time?
Right. You don't need to.
So Fire Sign realized that one of the things that the multi-track recording studio made possible was that you could and should make records where there's lots that you don't hear on the first time.
Well, stuff goes by so fast. References just fly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's almost always more than one thing going on.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you noticed that as well. And I'm guessing that, Mark, I don't know if you've outed yourself as a listener from the period, but I'm guessing that when you listened, you usually listened with other people.
Yeah. Right? And sometimes under the influence of nefarious substances.
Sure.
But however, I will say that sometimes interferes with you missing like half of the stuff that goes on. I mean, part of the stuff is it's sort of breathtaking, the changes in settings, the references. I mean, you know, it's the stuff flies by and the sounds really change. There's a logic to them, but you need to pick up on what the logic is and what's really going on. I mean, they're complicated records, and it's funny revisiting them. Now, like within the last 10 years, I started re-listening to a lot of them, and they're really complicated. And a lot of people today don't have the patience to listen to Fireside Theater.
Yeah, well, there's tons of things to listen to now, but I'm guessing we're usually listening while we're doing something else.
Right, probably. You can't do that with Fireside.
Everyone who's listening right now is like cooking or washing the dishes or driving or, you know, on the elliptical or whatever. And I know that's true for me too. But the Fireside records sound great in headphones, and people did listen with headphones, but even headphones themselves were not, they were not nearly as sort of widely distributed as they are now. So the experience of, you know, lying around on the floor of a dark room, listening with a bunch of other people was more like theater in a way, it seems.
And it's something that people don't do anymore. I mean, you don't have a group of people listening to a record.
Let's not speak for everybody, but yes, I do think that may generally be true. I do ask my students to say, no, we listen together. So,
you do, how's the response? Yeah.
From students?
Yeah.
Or just for people in general?
Students. Like, are you getting students listen to Fireside Theater?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just doing it this week, actually. There's a variety of responses. There's definitely some students whose minds are blown immediately, and that's really gratifying. and then there are people, as I'm sure there were at the time, and people whom I'm sure you and I both know, who are like, never make me listen to that ever again.
Exactly.
Because it's, you know, it can be really overwhelming. And then you know, people who are you know, engaged in audio culture generally, but have not experienced something like that before, and so are you know looking for ways of thinking about what it is that they just heard.
Part of it, I mean, and the other thing people have to remember is it's also really funny.
Yeah.
So that's going on, but I remember a lot of time was spent trying to decode references, trying to research, like, this obviously refers to something. I'm just not sure what it is. And then when somebody finally finds out that bit of information, it was like a huge revelation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, right. The 38th of Cunegonda.
Right.
When you finally read Candide, you realize that that's the name of a character. It's also, right, so the 38th of Cunegonda is just a passing reference on Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, which is an album that takes place ambiguously in a sort of fascist semi-future or semi-totalitarian semi-future, and the date is the 38th of Cunegonda. So on the one hand, you're in the world where there's a new calendar, right? So there's 38 days in a month, but one of the months is named after a character from Candide. And it really is like that, you know.
All the way down the line,
yeah.
That's the scary thing about the records that I see now as an older adult, is that the stuff is, I can't believe people listen to it. It's so complicated. I love
yeah,
it.
Well, but it's fun to know that there's more things to know, if you see what I mean, right?
Oh
that,
yeah, you know, I mean I'm on your page.
Yeah.
I know it is amazing. But I mean just the and again the sound quality as the record went from How Can You Be in Two Places and onward, the sound quality was very sophisticated for the time. All these multi-layered tracks are just amazing.
It really is amazing. That's for sure.
Okay, we're like 1 minute left. That's it.
Oh, okay.
favorite Firesign album? You?
I mean, you know,
just say it.
Okay, I guess my favorite is In the Next World, You're on Your Own, which is the last one that they recorded for Columbia. It's really, really dark.
It's really dark.
But it's also, I mean, you know, it's quite funny. It's quite funny as well. It's an album which on the first side is imagining, it tells the story of a family in which each family member sees the world according to a television genre. So it's, and one of the things, one of the many things that it's doing, I think, is reflecting on the earliest reality television, because the famous PBS documentary An American Family had just come out. David Osman had moved to Santa Barbara at that point, actually knew the famous
we're completely out of time.
Okay.
So tonight's guest
I'm done.
is Jeremy Braddock. He teaches literature, media, and sound studies at Cornell University, and we've been talking about his book, Firesign: The Electromagnetic History of Everything as Told on 9 Comedy Albums. Jeremy, it's been a real pleasure. I think I may have to have you back.
Okay, I'd be happy to do it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.
Los Angeles, he walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly toward his weekly meeting with the...